Provide say something again, Daniel.
Hyperspace is a first-person co-op player versus enemies game where you and your friends take the role as a crew of a spaceship.
Are you reading from your phone?
Yes. I told you, like, it's so hard to just make up an elevator pitch.
Reading from the product page on Steam.
Yeah, exactly. Basically.
Shams, say something.
Yep. That's right. It's good to be back. It is the best feeling to be back.
The best feeling.
The best feeling.
I think this is okay. I think we'll be fine.
We'll fix it in post.
Welcome back to another episode of the Business of Video Games podcast. We're your hosts, Daniel Goldberg, that's me, and my co-host,
Shams Trajani.
Good catch there, Shams. It's been, what, like a year? 2 years?
Almost.
A year and a half since we did the last one?
Time flies.
And I think pretty much everything has changed since. neither of us are still with Paradox. Both you and me have sort of new lives, new things to keep us busy. What you do takes a bit too long to describe, I think. So I'll summarize and say it's a mix of advising, consulting, and investing, and starting new businesses in the games industry. And I work as CCO at a nonprofit organization called Norrsken Foundation, where we invest in and help develop startups that are solving big global problems.
That sounds so much better than mine, being an entrepreneur.
But we missed doing podcasts a lot, and a few of you, kind of more than we expected actually, have actually reached out and told us that you miss listening to us, which is weird, but you know, nice. So we thought we should give it another go, have another go at doing a podcast. So we're back in the studio. We've missed it a lot. Some things are the same. This is still a podcast about the business of video games. It's here to shine a light on the dark underbelly of games publishing for those of you who for some reason or another may be interested in that, and hopefully make it all a bit less mysterious in the meantime. Some things have changed, though. For one, we're going to start bringing on guests more frequently now that we're no longer bound by, you know, sort of ironclad contracts barring us from speaking to anyone who isn't on Paradox payroll. We're going to look a bit more broadly across the industry, see if we can find some good guests to join us here in the studio.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I have to concur, it's really good to be back. Like we said, this is a podcast about games publishing and the business side of stuff. So we were looking at what we consider the most interesting people in the games industry, especially on the business side, to talk a little bit what they do, what they've learned, and what it is about the games industry that makes them stick around despite all the dark, terrible things that have happened over the years. What's also new in this format is that we're going to be having conversation with folks through the lens of maybe sometimes particular business decisions, challenges or truths that we take for granted, and we try to unpack them specifically. Why was this decision made, or why are they screwing up this other thing? But whereas we maybe did that with Paradox in the past, we'll be able to kind of invite interesting people from all over the industry and unpack those things. Hopefully.
That's true. Talk about other people's successes and fuck-ups, not just ours.
No, exactly. And we have plenty of our own. So, but one more thing. We're also starting a Patreon for the podcast. Why? Well, we both have jobs. Well, you do, Daniel.
I do, yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to be an entrepreneur. So it's not to put food on the table, precisely. We're doing a Patreon for this podcast for three kind of reasons. The first is to cover our costs for stuff like editing, quality, and distribution of the podcast. We have a guy who will be shipping out physical copies of the podcast.
On mini discs,
actually. The second is to help make it easier for guests to join. Sometimes they have to travel from all the way from Södermalm here in Stockholm, and it's very costly. But it's sometimes about to get them mix or get them into the studio or a quiet corner at GDC. And thirdly, longtime listeners will, of course, know this, is that we are huge fans of KPIs. That's key performance indicators for you business nerds out there. So if you feel we're doing a good job and you want to support us and maybe get a better show out of it, please consider throwing a few pesos at us at patreon.com/businessofvideogames.
For the first episode, we decided to talk to none other than the legendary Daniel Kaplan. Daniel Kaplan, also known as... Daniel, for those of you who may not know, has a long and pretty damn impressive career in the games industry behind him, from running business development at Mojang pretty much from day one to working with some of the most I would say, most successful indie releases of the past decade at Coffee Stain Publishing. Goat Simulator, Satisfactory, Valheim, to name a few of them. It seems everything Daniel has touched turns into Steam top seller gold. And Daniel is looking so awkward right now. This is, I'm going to keep showering you with praise and see and see how your
shower sort of him with gold.
It's very humbling to hear this, and I
it's not your turn yet.
Okay,
hold on.
Sorry.
Today, Daniel is actually managing his own studio again as CEO of Keepsake Games, developing the very cool-looking space simulator Hyperspace. I'm sure Daniel will give us the elevator pitch at some point in the podcast. But we wanted to bring him over to ask the big question. Is there a secret sauce to success in PC gaming? Because I think if there is, you should be the pretty close at least to figuring it out. Or is the simple answer, just be Daniel Kaplan? Daniel, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
How are you doing?
I'm well, a bit tired after the vacation. I thought it was going to be a breeze with two kids for 4 or 5 weeks, but it's not. It's actually more tiresome than work.
Yeah, it's the exact opposite, actually. Yeah,
this is vacation now. Exactly. It was the first day at work.
Holidays with kids is all about making you feel that your working life is actually pretty damn easy. By contrast, it is.
Welcome back to another episode of the Dad Podcast. Fantastic. Okay, so Daniel, let's kick this off. But as with always, what's your origin story?
I started my gaming industry career started with going to University of Gövde. That's where I studied back in 2005. And after that, when I graduated, I actually didn't know what to do. I applied for some jobs, and then some other folks at fellow students asked me if I wanted to join and make a new company. And I was like, yeah, sure. I studied. this is so weird. I have a bachelor in arts. Yes. So I was an artist for like 2 weeks.
What happened?
Yeah. So what happened was that we created this company, and no one really knew how to run a company. And I had worked in the past with my father in a pizza place and been dealing with customers and dealing with some paperwork and whatnot. So I took all the admin tasks, basically. So that was my job because no one else wanted to do it. So I was like, okay, we'll try to figure this one out. I had no training in economics or anything, or business administration, whatever. So it was a lot of try and fail, a lot of failing. Practice
making things up as you go along.
Yeah, exactly. So we made that company. It's called Ludosity. They're still around. The latest big game they made was called Nickelodeon All-Star Brawl, something like that. But yeah, that was super cool that they managed to make that game. And in 2009, I was in Malmö at a gaming jam called No More Sweden. And that's where I met Notch the first time. He had released the game Minecraft in May 2009. And everyone at the gaming jam was like, whoa, Notch. This guy has made it the big bucks. He was selling like 20, 30 copies a day from his own webpage. And that was like, awesome.
It's a different world.
Yeah, yeah. That was like, whoa, he's so successful. This is so cool. Like, look at this guy. He's sitting next to us. Like, we had never really met anyone who was successful really with their indie game. So we talked a little bit back then in Malmö. We didn't hang out that much. Like, he was very timid and very introvert back then. So that was my first encounter with Notch. And we had all played Minecraft and saw it. Like, and we saw it, like, selling more and more and more. And yeah. So, yeah. That was how I quit from Ludosity and eventually managed to know Notch. And then Notch, in the summer of 2010 or the August in 2010, he wrote on his blog, on his game development blog, which was also very unique back then to actually have one and talk about your in-development game. He said he wanted a CEO. So I actually applied for the CEO job at Mojang. I didn't get it. but they found another role for me, him and eventually Jacob and Carl. They asked me if I wanted to be the business developer for it because I had talked a lot with developers in the past. I traveled to GDC a couple of times. I had a lot of good connections with Steam because of the way I helped other developers during my time at Ludosity and this game jam, No More Sweden. I helped other devs to connect with Steam and stuff like that. And Notch didn't know back then what to do with his game and company and stuff like that. So I went on two interviews, I think, here in Stockholm with Notch and Jacob. And then I joined in August, September 2010.
So you spent a number of years with Mojang. I think everyone is familiar with what Mojang has become and what Minecraft has become. Yeah. And then you moved on to Coffee Stain.
Yes.
Where you've been, and the trajectory of Coffee Stain Publishing has also been pretty incredible over the past couple of years. Do you want to mention a couple of the titles that you worked on or that were released during your time there?
Yeah. So Coffee Stain was also very interesting. It's also from Hovde, where I grew up and went to university. And I knew them during my time at university. So we always kept in touch with Anton, me and Anton, the co-founder there. And he asked me like a year before I quit at Mojang, like, hey, are you sure you don't want to join us? Like we're thinking of making, you know, investing more in games and Goat Simulator. The Goat Simulator was already out back then.
And very successful at that time.
Yes,
right?
Yes. Yeah. And they wanted to make more games, but he felt they didn't have the bandwidth themselves. So they wanted to help other in this because they also struggled, even though they had like a quite big success with the Sanctum, their previous title before Goat Simulator. So we started the company Coffee Stain Publishing, and I was one of the founders of Coffee Stain Publishing. And I worked on Goat Simulator 3, actually. That was what I spent most of my time on, which was announced a month or two ago.
Yeah.
So I spent a lot of time on Goat Simulator 3 and managing that and helping out and making the business development for that and helping out making an Epic exclusive. I was also part of making Satisfactory an Epic exclusive.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
And the reason for that, why they were exclusive, why they became exclusives were because we didn't know. Like Coffee Stain had put in a lot of money in Satisfactory themselves. They had invested everything basically they had in Satisfactory.
Yeah.
And it was a big risk for them. So it was all about de-risking the project and convincing someone else to join you in this journey of making Satisfactory.
Yeah, because obviously striking an exclusive like that means, as you say, de-risking the project.
Yes.
It's kind of revenue in, and then you might be exchanging that for some upside, you don't know, but the point is that you remove some of the risk.
Exactly.
But looking back at Satisfactory, this is a bit detailed maybe, but I was following that game myself. Like even from announcement, I would say, there was a lot of buzz around that game. I'm assuming that whatever metrics that you guys were following looked really good.
Yes.
But even then, as you say, you didn't know. Like, was there not confidence enough in that product to say that, no, we're not going to go exclusive with some... And Epic at the time was smaller than they are today as well.
Correct.
But we're going to release broadly and we're going to release on Steam. Was there still that sort of hesitation?
There was a lot of discussions whether going with Epic or releasing ourselves on Steam, etc. But the project was very expensive for Coffee Stain. So we just felt that we need the cash because we don't know if the game will be successful.
Mm-hmm.
Or not. And we had basically, we made a deal with Epic after the announcement.
Immediately after the announcement.
Kinda, yeah. That's what got them hyped as well.
Right.
But seeing the pickup of the announcement.
But it wasn't. But the exclusivity wasn't announced until quite a lot later, or
I think
I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly.
There was a lot of drama in those early days as well.
Yes.
And I remember you and I talked at some point as well around that. I think this is interesting, both from the outside. It looked like Coffee Stain was this powerhouse that had you. Sick momentum.
I remember we were watching Satisfactory at Paradox and just saying, holy shit, like this looks incredible.
Yeah. So
how did they build so much attention for this? And you're saying that on the inside, I'm simplifying it obviously, but you guys were as kind of nervous or unsure as we were about our projects at the time.
We were super nervous.
Yeah.
And we actually reworked the project for like 1.5 years when we joined the publishing team because we weren't part of the initial development of the game. I had my very good colleague, Tim Badilak, shout out. he actually worked basically day and night with the team to rework concepts of parts of the game to make it look more sexy, more entertaining, more accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why Satisfactory had so great trailers is credit to Tim because he worked a lot with the team in terms of making super cool trailers.
If you haven't seen that first announcement trailer, watch it. It's incredible. One of the best, I think, in the industry. Yeah. And the use of Magnus the Magnus and Eye of the Eye for the soundtrack is amazing.
I agree. So there was, you mentioned Goat Simulator, obviously, as the first big success, if you will, and then Satisfactory after that, I think. And then
yes,
Valheim, was that did that come immediately after that, or was there
actually Deep Rock really Galactic, which right, I worked yeah. a little bit
that little game.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. So great. So game, to be completely fair, like there was very few games actually worked super actively on. Goat Simulator 3 is the one I worked the most on.
Right.
The other ones I like helped out a lot with the deals and making sure they made sense, etc. Like a lot of feedbacking loop, and which is a lot of the time I do. It's a big part of the job is feedbacking, helping, organizing, facilitating, etc. Information and what makes sense, what doesn't make sense. So with Deep Rock Galactic, that was the first game Coffee Stain Publishing actually signed.
Right.
And that was also like a scary moment because we didn't get so good initial feedback with that because people felt like, oh, it's too little content. But we did know that the core was great. The day I played it, the first day I played it, it was like, yeah, this is super cool. Like the core was super good. And we felt that the game needed more content, and we also delayed that. Like that's the red thread here. Yeah. The common theme in my game career is that delaying games so far has resulted in more success.
Yeah.
So one of the key indicators of success that I know of is that I would always trade time rather than more people on the project. Because a lot of the time you just need to make sure you have a really good core before accelerating in achieving some kind of launch.
But you also had the luxury of being able to afford an extension.
Exactly.
Did you end up in situations where you had to where to ask yourself, like, do we put more money in? What does that do with the P&L? Was that something that factored in to these extensions?
Yes, they absolutely did. And that's where the Epic exclusive helped. We basically went to break even from day one with the Epic exclusive. And that helped us to invest more of our own money. We knew that as long as we just release, we're golden. So we could delay it. And Epic was all about delaying as well, because they were like, yeah, of course, you should make a better game. Right. And that's one of the things that I learned during my time at Coffee Stain, is that when you have found a solid core, that's when you're gonna accelerate, not prior to that.
Yeah, I was gonna ask you this.
Because it becomes so expensive.
I was gonna ask you this. Actually, like, there's some obvious sort of threads, as you mentioned, in you know, the projects that you've been, or at least, you know, the studios that you've been part of have brought to market. I mean, all of them are sort of first and foremost PC titles. I would say you would typically label them indie games. Again, even though it's a clumsy term. There's something sort of offbeat and not really sort of initially mainstream when you look at those concepts. You know, whether it's, I mean, I guess you could include Minecraft in that as well back in the day, right?
Yeah.
And they all sort of emphasize creativity, player expression. There's stuff like that, right? I mean, does this sort of resonate with you? Do you agree that there's a theme here? And
Definitely think so. It could also be like a trend overall in games. Like, you're supposed to have customization, you're supposed to be able to change outfits and whatnot and customize the game to make it feel more like your own. And that was something I definitely felt during my time at Mojang, was that at one point it was not our own game anymore. It was like the community was driving the game. And you had to listen to them, otherwise it wouldn't be good.
Yeah. Did you find that ended up being a bit of a problem at Coffee Stain as well?
Sometimes. Yeah, sometimes, because a lot of the other devs were not used to that. That you actually have to take the players in consideration rather than us being the main messengers of the game. Like, here is our work. You just have to consume.
Yeah. It's the curse of building a successful community, right? At some point, they own the thing. You don't own the thing anymore.
Exactly. Are you not entertained?
Yeah. Kind of that thing.
Yeah. So let me ask you then, again, because it looks so easy from the outside. Were there some other points of dilemma or challenges that you had to deal with internally, like hard decisions to make?
Delaying projects is always hard, and that's not anyone does lightly, because everyone just wants to be done with it at some point. Like, there's also like a risk of fatigue, obviously, that the dev team is being worked out, because they feel that they have made everything they can.
Sure. And
usually everyone I've met is very hardworking.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things I definitely felt.
So the theme of this podcast, as we set it up, was is there a secret sauce to success in PC gaming, right?
Yeah.
And you mentioned one thing there, a clear takeaway there, which is like you're saying that you would always prioritize time over people.
Yes.
On a project. Are there any other sort of secret ingredients here? Are there any sort of learnings that you've built over the year that you think are key in making a successful release?
Early verification, in terms of like trying somehow to test with like real people. And that could be everything from making a trailer, posting a screenshot, and see what sticks. And that's also very hard because people can make like super cool GIFs on Twitter and they get like 1,000 likes and a gazillion of retweets. But you also have to understand that even though they have like a super cool GIF, it doesn't mean that they can actually make a proper game out of it. You have to choose like what to show, and you have to understand yourself like, okay, this thing, specific thing resonates with the audience.
How did you guys balance internal testing versus external validation? Like, I think a lot of people say validation is important, but...
It is. But we actually run a lot with gut feeling initially before we actually made external play tests.
Mm-hmm.
The trailer that we did for Satisfactory, the one that you mentioned, that gave us a lot of confidence, a lot of wind in the sails internally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because momentum, yeah, exactly. Because even back then, I remember that a lot of people internally in the studio were struggling with what's the vision of the game. And making a trailer, I think it's a very good thing in terms of like a communication tool, not just marketing tool, but specifically internally, because that helps everyone envision what the game is about, because you're supposed to sell a vision with the trailer.
Exactly.
And sell a feeling of what this game is about.
Completely agree with that. It helps align everyone around what it is, what's the promise you're actually selling here.
And we actually got feedback from the game developers at Coffee Stain. They were like, now I understand what game we make. Even though they had worked on the game for like 2 years, now I understand. Oh, I'm definitely on this.
So can we break into this dynamic? Because you gave Tim Badelak a lot of credit for creating that trailer and working actively with the team. At what point one of the problems we had at Paradox is that sometimes marketing wanted to push a aspect or a persona of the game that wasn't quite true.
Yeah.
So you ended up selling something that wasn't
really
there.
Who agrees what the product is that you're selling, right?
Exactly. And then you end up... And then suddenly you are beholden to what you've actually sold in, and then suddenly the developers have to pivot. And you're describing a scenario where that ended up being a good thing.
Yeah, but the idea with our trailers was never to overpromise anything.
Okay.
It was just to show off the vision of the game, what's the aspect, what we believe we will ship eventually. We had all the features, they were buggy as hell, but it was all made up for the trailer. But the idea was not to try to make something not sincere.
Yeah.
Like it was always a bit, because we were very keen on reflecting the truth of the game as well, because we didn't, that's an idea we had as well, that with all our marketing trailers and material, it was about being truthful, because we knew that people instantly would give us a shitty review if we were trying to market something we weren't. Yeah,
but it goes hand in hand with the point about a trailer being a very, you know, very powerful internal tool as well, because it doesn't really matter who decides. It's more like everyone has to sort of genuinely, authentically agree that this is the game we're making, right?
Yeah.
It also doesn't sound like the dev team was necessarily taken by surprise about the image that was presented in the trailer of the game. It came from the developers rather than marketing.
Oh yeah, definitely. It was in working with in tandem with the developers, and like this thing doesn't look so good in the trailer. Can we polish it up, etc.?
Okay, good.
So it also helped the whole team to focus on what to polish up.
I think
because
this is
wanted it to look good in the trailer.
This sounds like a good example of when publishing
does a good job,
quotation marks and development work closely together. Whereas sometimes at Paradox, I could feel like sometimes developers were taken a little bit by surprise about what was presented.
Yeah. Oh no, that we never had any surprise, as far as I know.
Yeah.
Because everything was approved by the developers always, because we didn't want to try to sell something that it wasn't.
It needs to come from. There needs to be clarity and all throughout, right?
Yes, and a lot of the trailers we made were also recorded by the developers, and then we helped them facilitate the script, etc. Like, this shot is not so good. Can we re-record it?
Can we frame it this way?
Yeah, exactly.
So clarity of vision, I guess, is what we're talking about here.
Absolutely.
In a sense.
And that's probably one of the hardest things to do in a game, especially in the early days of the game, yep. Like trying to find your way.
So what do you think the key to success was for Valheim then?
So Valheim was a weird one. The guy who made the game, majority of the game, Rickard Svensson, he had already worked on it quite a lot, and it comes back again to early verification. Mm. He had, it was usually, back then it was called Fade. Mm. It was released on itch.io, and he had already gotten some traction and got some feedback, and people were interested into that. We knew that the core was really well, like we spent a lot of time playing it ourselves in the publishing team and really enjoyed it, and like, oh yeah, this feels like really good, like just punching trees and crafting stuff, etc. Like it was all like very entertaining, like even from day one. Mm. But it didn't look as good as it eventually became, in my opinion. And he used as well, similarly to Songs of Conquest, a lot of like post-processing effects, like super high def,
bloom.
Light, exactly, bloom, god rays, etc. Yeah. And that makes the game look beautiful.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't have worked as well without those effects, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And so it's this mix of like old tech versus new tech in both Songs of Conquest and Valheim.
Mm.
And that was a way, and he did it all himself, but in the Songs of Conquest game, the publishing team pushed for that.
Yeah.
And that was before Valheim.
So just coming back to what you mentioned earlier, at Coffee Stain, is there, you know, is there like a process on where you start getting, as Shams was saying, external feedback on a concept in terms of like, you know, in terms of your signing and publishing process? And if so, when does that happen?
It's a bit hard to say. We didn't have a concrete process back then when I worked there. It was all about gut feeling, like, yeah, this feels nice. Now it's ready to be shown off. And the reason why we could do it that way and we didn't have like any specific hard dates was because the teams were quite small and we knew we could run them for a very long time. Like the burn rate wasn't that high. So there was no like real specific milestones in that sense. It was more about like, we like this core. Now can you try to make it into a proper game? And that was the process. It was a lot of gut feeling.
Right. How many projects would you say, you know, percentage-wise, are killed off for every game that is actually released?
In Coffee Stains, I think we only killed one. I wish we killed two, maybe three.
Yeah, okay. But
so it wasn't that many. But we didn't sign that many games either.
Right.
We were quite picky with the games we chose, and it was partially based on bandwidth, because our producers and me and the other guys, we were very invested in each project. Like you took the game from, we had to play Axe to Limpa.
From Axe to Limpa.
Axe to Limpa, yeah. From, I mean, the whole...
From start to finish.
Exactly. From an embryo to a proper baby or adult.
Yeah.
So that was basically your responsibility. So you invested a lot of time in each project as a producer.
So instead of cancellation, you kept the burn rate low and allowed those games to continue for a longer time until they found more success.
Yes. And that could be like getting a great tweet or having someone playtest and get a lot of feedback. So it was different kind of thing, or feeling in the team that, yeah, this is awesome. Let's continue.
So let's leave Coffee Stain and talk a little bit about your most recent project, I guess. So you recently decided to set up your own studio called Keepsake Games.
Correct.
And were you the CEO?
Yes.
Yes. Would it be fun if you had said no?
What the hell? Why do we have this guy on? Like, let's bring on the CEO.
The first game you're working on is called Hyperspace. And so you describe it rather than me. How would you describe it? And Daniel is now bringing up his phone.
I'm going to read. Like, I think it's so hard to just make these elevator pitches. Yeah. But Hyperspace is a first-person co-op adventure game where you and your friends take the role as a crew of a spaceship. You'll be flying the ship, you'll be firefighting and optimizing energy flows, manning the turrets, and exploring the shipwrecks and go on a space adventure. So the game is basically, we're heavily influenced by Left 4 Dead and Sea of Thieves, and Faster Than Light, FTL. And this is kind of like a mix of all those.
Mm.
Um, And we're combining different genres, like the flying part is very different from the FPS part, and it's very seamless transitions from those.
So if we look back at those secret sauces we talked about, de-risking projects, keeping burn low, add time, not people, grow once you've established the core, early verification, see what sticks, especially publicly, and clarity of vision. Are these things that you are sticking to with this
game? Some of them, I would say. I know all of the other founders did not agree with me on all these points, obviously.
Obviously.
But we had early verification. It was the guy, one of the founders who is called Philip Koulianos. He made the first early prototype of the game. And he made videos of it, and he got some traction for it. And so that's check mark number one.
Check.
Early verification.
Well, yes.
And
when
then
you say he made videos, you mean this is also stuff that wasn't just shown internally?
It wasn't shown as
It was on YouTube, like proper viewers.
Real humans.
Real humans. And he actually made a demo that like some smaller magazines picked up. For instance, Rock Paper Shotgun. They wrote an article about it saying how cool it was, this mix of genres. So there was also another verification, like real people writing real articles and creating content with the game.
Also throwing shade on the small publication of Rock Paper Shotgun. So you just know that, guys. John Walker, screw yourself.
Small.
Small.
I don't know how big it is today, but it used to be quite small. Yeah. But it is growing, I guess.
Yeah, but we want to start as many industry beefs as we possibly can to get some drama going. So we're just going to hashtag into the...
Sorry.
We'll fix it in post. Don't worry. Yes.
So okay. Keep going, Daniel. You were saying, so early verification was obviously there. What are the sort of other, I guess, what you're bringing with you to this project based on previous
things? One thing I learned as well was working more with consultants, like external freelancers and stuff like that. So we had quite a small team. We were five. And now we've grown to 10 this August. But that was to keep like burn rate low and figure out more parts of the game before growing. But I still think we're growing quite slowly. And that's, in my opinion, healthy. So we're still trying to keep burn rate low, even though 10 is big. Like, I would rather have not had 10. But we had to figure out some parts in the team and stuff like that.
Any other methods of de-risking in terms of financial or...?
Get someone who finances your project.
that's a very good way of de-risking. Yeah, I mean it's similar to the Epic discussion,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly similar to the Epic discussion. And this project was de-risked thanks to Philip, who made the project on his spare time during his life at Hazelight, where he was the main designer there, lead designer. And he worked on this game on his spare time. So that was a way of de-risking the project.
Sure.
He didn't quit his job till we more or less had a deal. So that's a way of de-risking as well. Get money from somewhere else to make your dream game.
Is there anything that you can sort of point to that is new that you're trying for the first time here? I mean, I guess there's many things.
Future secret recipe? Ingredient? That?
Yeah, exactly. What's the new ingredient this time? In terms of how you're approaching actually bringing this to market and making it successful.
Maybe self-publishing.
Are you?
Is that decided?
Self-publishing?
No, it's not decided.
okay. You heard it here first, kids.
I said maybe.
Maybe.
Tell us about your thinking there, though. That's interesting.
I think there are both positives and negatives with publishers. Obviously, it depends on like how much of the work you want to do yourself. Like everyone has their own role. Just like we will use external people to help us with QA. Because that's a hard job that we would rather have someone else do, because I think our team can focus on something else and the QA team will focus on QA. Same with publishing. It all depends on like how good we are at maintaining relationship with various partners, and being associated with other people helps a lot as well. Just a branding thing, basically. And like I said, like the PR part, the trailer making part, the feedbacking part, that's also a job, even though it's hard to define. And that was one of the strugglers we were having with when I was at Coffee Stain. We got a lot of questions from devs like, oh, why should we sign with a publisher again, just go and sell it on Steam? We're like, yeah, sure, you can. Everyone can. But there's a lot of different other things you can't do maybe as yourself, because you're going to do the code, you're going to do the art, the music, the testing, the blah, 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 blah. Making a game is hard. And it depends on how many hats you want to wear, basically.
So this is actually interesting to get your perspective on the value a publisher brings as someone who's been on, I guess, all sides of that equation at some point or another. And it sounds like what you're saying is essentially like allowing you to, the more things that will allow you to focus on the core is probably a good thing, or could be a good thing, I guess, depending on where you are financially.
I think so. And since we already got some funding, that's one part that I definitely think a publisher should do, fund parts or the whole project. Because they're getting a product they're selling in the end, so they should be part of financing that.
Well, Daniel, thank you so much for visiting us today. Before we let you move out of here, as we always do on the podcast, what have you been playing recently?
I've only been playing games that my son plays, so that's been a lot of Forza Horizon.
How old is your son?
19.
5. And sitting there next to him, being frustrated that he can't steer properly and not drive properly.
Do you find yourself grabbing the joypad and sort of?
I'm struggling
more often than
you'd like. Yeah, I have to put a lot of effort into not doing that. It's hard, but he enjoys it a lot, and it's fun. It's a fun activity.
Daniel, as we said, thank you again for coming on. We wish you the best of luck with Hyperspace and with Forza, with your son.
Thank you.
For those of you who have been listening, that's it for the first episode of the new and improved Business of Video Games podcast. We hope you liked it. We hope you liked the new format. Please let us know what you think. Hit us up on Twitter. Both me and Shams are there. Daniel's there as well, if you want to tell him he's right or wrong or give him some pointers. I lost my train of thought there. What was I going to say? I had such a vibe going, and I kind of just lost it. But also just let us know who you think should come on the podcast. We're always looking for suggestions on who we should bring in and have an honest, open discussion, conversation about things that have to do with games. So thanks again for listening.
Thanks.
Cheers, everyone.
Bye-bye.